This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The verdict is in from space and from ground. The world's tropical forests are releasing their masses of carbon into an already overloaded atmosphere. It's a climate signal as big as the meltback of Arctic sea ice in 2007. You will hear breaking science from NASA and Woods Hole. In the face of inevitable disasters to come, we also have Daniel Lurch from the Post-Carbon Institute. He will talk about resilience in a time of upheaval. I'm Alex Smith with three new interviews. Let's get going.
Radio EcoShock.
While we live and sleep, in space, NASA operates an Orbiting Carbon Observatory, or OCO. Actually, this is version 2, launched in 2014, after the first one malfunctioned during deployment in 2009. Now scientists have announced a wave of new findings about the way carbon works in our atmosphere. In times of rapid climate change, this is need-to-know information. Actually, NASA has released 5 studies in one, I think, from 21 scientists, by my count. It's huge, and it's all published in the journal Science on October 13th. Fortunately, we have as our guide a lead author with an overview. She is Dr. Anne-Marie Eldering with the Carbon Observatory Project. From the NASA Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California, Anne-Marie, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Nice to be here.
Well, the paper's titled The Orbiting Carbon Observatory 2, Early Science Investigations of Regional Carbon Dioxide Fluxes. But help me out, Anne-Marie, is this one paper or five?
So this is a collection of 5 papers with the overview I wrote and then 4 distinct findings. But we highlight the paper about the atmospheric fluxes because that's really the science question OCO2 was designed to go after.
I've been speaking with other scientists about carbon loss from tropical forests, and it's a huge topic. There's some new carbon news that you people have brought out. And I was talking with Alessandro Bacini, for example, from the Woods Hole Research Center and his new study in the journal Science. And it's worrying for climate and forest activists to think that the tropical forests are losing carbon. So let's explore that study by Junji Liu et al. Please tell us about the great cycle of plants and carbon during the year.
Okay, so a little bit of background. As you know, the plants are an important regulator of the seasonal cycle of atmospheric carbon dioxide. They take it up and release it and put a big seasonal cycle pattern into the record that we have of CO2. And they're also very important because humans are emitting carbon dioxide, and the land and the ocean take up about half of what gets emitted every year. So in effect, dampening the impact of what we add to the atmosphere. And we were fortunate once OCO2 was launched in 2014, not that long after, one of the largest El Niños on record got started, the El Niño of 2015-2016. So this was like a big natural experiment. What happens when there's more heat and more drought? How are the plants going to respond? And we saw the largest increase in the atmospheric CO2 growth rate that we've ever seen, in fact, in 10,000 years. And we now can explain why that happened based on the work that Junji's team did to explore the tropics and their response to the El Niño conditions and to the heat and the drought.
This study by Liu reveals the biosphere lost 2.5 gigatons more carbon from the tropics in 2015 than just 4 years earlier in 2011. And to me, that is stunning. And can you talk to us about why that happened?
Definitely. So she studied 2015, which was the big El Niño year, relative to 2011, which was more like a normal year, and indeed found this 2.5 gigatons of carbon released. And when she looked at it in detail, what she found was that there were 3 tropical regions that released extra carbon: the tropical parts of South America, Africa, and then Indonesia. And in fact, they all had a different reason for releasing extra carbon. In South America, there was much less rain. It was a drought, one of the biggest droughts in 30 years. And so the plants just didn't grow as much as they normally do. Therefore, they didn't remove carbon dioxide, and you had extra in the atmosphere. In Africa, it was a different story. The plants grew as normal, but it was very, very warm. So a lot of the material on the ground, the dead leaves, and decomposed very rapidly, and that released the carbon dioxide. In Indonesia, you're probably aware that there were some very large peat fires in that time period, and that was the biggest source of carbon dioxide. So we had three different effects happening in those three different regions.
And two of those from the El Nino or during the El Nino are the same conditions projected to become more regular as climate change develops. What does that tell us, Anne-Marie, about the future role of tropical forests as regulators of atmospheric carbon?
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head. We're very interested in the implications that indeed about 30% of the climate models predict heat and drought conditions in the future that are similar to what we see in El Nino. And this work shows that less carbon gets taken up by tropical land, so you're going to have more rapid increased rates of carbon dioxide because the land won't do as much as it's doing right now to help remove that.
Are we talking about a positive feedback mechanism from the tropics now, where increasing carbon loss drives increasing carbon loss?
That is indeed the implication of this work.
And I guess this is outside the scope of the work, but the usual solutions, I suppose, that humans could take to reduce carbon loss from the tropics, what can we do?
Well, I think the work we're focused on about the natural cycles are something that we're not going to have much influence on. So it's really about learning what those natural cycles might do, understanding the implications, and then as we think about our plans and how we will manage carbon in the future, it's important to know that something like this positive feedback could be happening. I think we maybe had a lot of uncertainty. It was hard to make some decisions around this issue, but if we can reduce uncertainty with work like this, it could help us make some better plans down the road.
Now, you're in California during the mega fires as we speak, and I'm wondering if those fires are kind of a small reflection of the data coming in from these satellite observations. And I want to ask you a second question along those lines. How does that relate to the study led by Florian Schwander about observations of Los Angeles taken from space?
Yeah, so you're right. I'm in California and we're having some huge fires right now. We actually just had a discussion that the magnitudes of these fires are actually quite small when you think about the comparison to, say, what happens in Africa and Indonesia. So we may see a little signal, but it's quite small, factor of 10 to 50 less being emitted in these types of things. Florian's study about Los Angeles was quite interesting. We definitely have information about how the carbon dioxide in cities is higher than the background. People have told us about this from ground-based stations and from other remote sensing measurements. But the real value in what Florian showed was that with just a few minutes of measurements from OCO2, you see this contrast of the enhanced carbon dioxide elevated by 4, 5, 6 parts per million in Los Angeles relative to the background. So it really demonstrates the capability of the remote sensing technique that OCO2 uses. And that was one of the goals of this mission, to really show we in fact can see small changes. We can see these gradients over small areas. And now that we see this technique work so well, it can help us imagine the future and think about directions we can go.
Well, maybe in the future we'll be able to look at a map or check our phones and find out what our current carbon emissions are in the city where we live.
That's a great goal to have as we move down the road.
All right. Now, another study in this package by Abhishek Chatterjee talks about, quote, a near-total shutdown of sea-to-air flux of carbon during the 2015-2016 boreal winter. What does that mean, and should we worry about it?
So Abhishek studied the equatorial Pacific Ocean, and he was following up on a hypothesis that people had that when El Nino occurred, the ocean circulation changes a bit. So there's a water in the ocean that's very cold and holds a lot of carbon, and typically it upwells in this equatorial Pacific region and releases some of that carbon to the atmosphere. And in El Nino condition, you don't have that same upwelling, and therefore you don't have the same release of carbon into the atmosphere. So Abhishek looked at our data and sees a nice time series of how this capping of the upwelling was happening, and for a few months you saw a decrease of about 1%, half a part per million in the carbon dioxide over the ocean area. And then as time went on, that signal was overwhelmed by what was happening on the land. And so I think this again is valuable in seeing how response of the ocean is happening, and again, trying to think about the future and our best prediction of what might happen. Certainly, the ocean is another important buffer in holding on to the carbon dioxide that we emit into the atmosphere. But if there's some changes in the temperatures and the circulation, we certainly expect that there'll be some changes in the carbon storage.
Now, another topic we've been talking with scientists about here on Radio EcoShock is about how volcanoes can cool global weather for the short term, a year or more, versus that longer-term greenhouse gas emissions from the same eruption. It's still a bit murky to me. What do we know about that, and does the Orbiting Carbon Observatory help clear up that question?
Yeah, so volcanoes are always an interesting thing, and they're a big event at the moment they happen, but they usually don't last too long. So when you put together your budget of all the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, you must account for them, but they're a pretty small player in the global sense. But for people like Florian Schwander, who led this paper, his main scientific interest is volcanoes, and no one had really shown how much carbon dioxide they release in a remote sensing measurement before. So he was able to show that you can see the plumes of emissions from the volcanoes. You can even estimate the amount of carbon dioxide they're releasing, and it makes sense with other estimates people have developed. So it's really, again, demonstrating we have the precision. We don't see a lot of the Earth. We only sample about 6% of the mass of the land over our 16-day repeat cycle. But in the instances where we flew over these points of interest, he actually was able to get a quantified estimate of the release from the volcanoes. So it's good to help us test our models and see if we have a good understanding. And if a future data set had a denser set of samples, it might be able to provide that type of information for a larger set of these types of sources.
Okay, so you brought up something really interesting. What does this satellite offer that other related satellites can't or don't do?
So the big advance that OCO2 has made is this small footprint and high density of data. In the time frame of the original OCO mission, the Japanese launched something called GOSAT, and it's a measurement of greenhouse gases. GOSAT has shown to provide a lot of value to the scientific community, but it provides about 1/100th of the data density compared to OCO2. And in addition, we have a little bit better precision on our data than GOSAT did. So in finding some of the sources and sinks and quantifying the natural processes that are happening, the additional density of the OCO2 data is providing us the ability to see these sources and quantify them on a smaller scale compared to what we ever did before. So I think we can see smaller sources and we can work on smaller areas than we ever did before with these kind of data sets.
I'm hearing an echo from the Cold War when the first satellites were developed and they got more and more accurate to where it was said they could pick out a shovel in a backyard in Russia. And now we're getting to that point with carbon in the atmosphere. That's pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah, we're not quite at the shovel scale, but we're certainly at the your neighborhood scale for a single measurement. It's interesting.
You're listening to New Science on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Anne-Marie Eldering from the NASA Jet Propulsion Lab in Pasadena, California. Your study, the one that you led, helps us understand that big picture of how carbon changes in the atmosphere due to plants. I'm wondering, am I correct to assume that because there's a bigger land mass, plants in the northern hemisphere have a greater impact on the atmosphere, or do algae in the great oceans of the southern hemisphere balance that out somehow?
No, that's a very interesting question. What we have seen in our data set, as well as in some of the records before us, is that in the northern hemisphere, you have two important influences that really lead to a lot of dynamic changes over the year. You have the plants that grow in the spring and draw a lot of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere very, very rapidly. And then you also have a lot of the human population of the world, which is continuing to emit carbon dioxide. So you have increasing concentrations in the winter as the emissions build up, and then rapid decrease in spring and summer as the plants remove a lot of carbon dioxide. So you have this up and down cycle in the northern hemisphere that's very strong. It's order 10 parts per million. And in the southern hemisphere, when you look at the time record, it's much, much flatter because the land mass is smaller. The plants don't have that big influence. The number of humans and the emissions there are much smaller. So you have more like a kind of constant creeping up of concentration that's just due to this mixing of everything around the globe. So what happens in the northern hemisphere eventually mixing down into the southern hemisphere and bringing a rising concentration over time.
But can the Orbiting Carbon Observatory 2 measure changes in emissions by ocean algae, and should we expect more science to come out on that?
That's a great question. The ocean fluxes are actually quite small, and in our current assessment, most of the ocean changes will be very hard for us to detect. It might be if a big event happens or we have a long enough time series, we can start to eke some of that out. But at our current understanding is that the land exchange will be the most evident signal and the first one the scientists will really be able to quantify, and big changes in the ocean don't happen that often, so it'll be a harder problem to get numbers for.
I have to admit, I found assessing five studies at once a bit daunting. Would you just take a few minutes or as long as you need and tell us about some of the other important results from this latest publication?
I would love to. Yeah, we decided that five papers at one might have a more of an impact, but it certainly can be a lot to try to get through. So we talked about Junji's studies of the tropical land masses, and I mentioned Abhishek's analysis of how the oceans responded. Florian's work on the volcanoes and on looking at the city quantification, again, is a nice demonstration of the precision and sensitivity that we have with this data set. And the other piece of work that's included here is one on solar-induced fluorescence. So it turns out that satellites that measure the particular wavelength of light capture a little bit of light that's being emitted by plants while they perform photosynthesis. So OCO2 is able to quantify that signal and see the activity of the plants. And the direction that people are going with that data set is trying to understand its relationship to the gross primary productivity, or kind of how much plant material is being produced. And in the past, we've seen that there's some sort of a linear relationship between the SIF measurement and GPP, but it's never been clear if there's a universal relationship or it changes with a different type of plants. And now that we have OCO2 data that has small footprints, it's very precise and it can be compared in a very direct way to the flux towers, which is the ground-based way we measure this primary productivity. Ying has shown that, in fact, these are very linearly related across all of the different types of plants that she studied. So this is giving us further evidence that the measurement we have from space is closely related to a characteristic we care about and can help us understand the plant's behaviors and responses. Again, when Junji studied how the heat and the drought of El Nino impacted the tropical regions, the solar-induced fluorescence was one of the measurement data sets she used. She used carbon dioxide, water, and precipitation, the temperature, the SIF signal, and carbon monoxide that's measured by another instrument but tells her something about fire. So these data sets all actually link together.
You had me back at the idea that plants emit light when they perform photosynthesis. I had no idea that happened.
Yeah, there's a many scientists who spend time in the field with little spectrometers and look at this light, and even some of the so there's many signals that people have been looking at that are related to this, but you can actually see a very specific pattern of light that plants do emit, and it's detectable just as a small change of a few percent in the measurements that we have.
Wow. Well, I see that NASA's Goddard Earth Science Data Center provides a lot of this carbon data from the satellites to the public at three levels, I'm reading, and from massive detail to global maps of carbon dioxide. I think most of our listeners would settle for the maps. Do you have any way that we can find them?
Yeah, we've tried to make it easy because we love to get our data into everybody's hands. So if they go to our website, oco2.jpl.nasa.gov, From the main menu, you can find a gallery of videos and of stills, and in those collections, you'll find time series maps of our data that they can browse and review, as well as a few details about how we make our measurement and how our instrument's built.
I see you're also a project scientist with OCO3. What is going on with that?
Well, if you got a good thing going, just keep going with it, is my thinking. So we were fortunate, after the loss of OCO, NASA realized this was an important measurement, so they allowed us to move forward with the OCO2 project, or a rebuild of that same instrument. And while we did that, it was decided to build a spare one, just in case some other problems happened. So after OCO2 was launched successfully, we worked with NASA to develop a plan for continuing our measurement record of carbon dioxide. So that spare instrument's being wrapped up in a way that's compatible with the International Space Station, and the plan is that we would install this on the International Space Station maybe next year and then continue to have more measurements of atmospheric carbon dioxide.
You get another wow for that. I'm really looking forward to it. We've been talking about another huge science release, this time a collection of 5 studies based on results from NASA's Orbiting Carbon Observatory 2, also known as OCO2. And all that was published in the journal Science on October 13, 2017. You can find links to this whole discussion in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Our guide has been Dr. Anne-Marie Eldering, a project scientist with the Orbiting Carbon Observatory project. Anne-Marie, thanks so much for taking time to talk with us.
Thanks for your interest.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
For a very long time, carbon has been taken out of the atmosphere by the plant world, and we count on those services from the vast fabric of tropical rainforests. But all that has changed. New science proves tropical forests are a net carbon source. Our guest, Alessandro Baccini, is the lead author of that paper, published September 28th in the journal Science. Dr. Baccini works at the Woods Hole Research Center. He specializes in analyzing Earth from space using satellites. From Massachusetts, Alessandro, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
When you worked at the Food and Agriculture Organization at the United Nations in the 90s, what was the assumption about the role of tropical forests and atmospheric carbon?
At that time, most of the information that we had about the role of forests in the carbon cycle was coming from what each country actually knew about their forests. And as you can understand that some of the tropical countries, given the limitation in resources, it was very difficult for them to have a good assessment of the amount of forest, amount of carbon stored in the vegetation. So we had to work with a lot of assumptions and in some ways not the best information to come up with an assessment. But overall, the general understanding is that forests, through the photosynthesis, are able to absorb CO2 from the atmosphere, right, and release oxygen. And this exchange has been usually positive in the sense that there was more removal from the atmosphere than the emissions. And let me just be clear about what we intend by emissions from forests. Right. Emission from forests don't happen when you cut a tree, right? It's not that it's like a water pipe, that you cut the pipe and then the water is going to leak out. That's not how the emission, the carbon, the CO2 goes into the atmosphere. But in the case of forests, it's through the process of decomposition of the wood, of the timber, because timber is made of biomass, and 50% of that is actually carbon. So when the wood decomposes, that carbon that is stored in the tree, in the wood, will at some point go back into the atmosphere. It could be a very slow process in case of a natural decay, or it could be very fast in case, for example, of fire. If there is a forest fire, the wood, the carbon that is stored in that wood will go into the atmosphere right away. right? That's the process that releases carbon into the atmosphere from forests. And what we presented in this new study is that there is so much pressure in the forest, in the tropics, there is so much loss and disturbance that the amount of carbon that goes into the atmosphere is bigger than the amount of carbon that the forests are able to remove. It's not that the forests are not removing any more the carbon. It's just that forests are less and less. And so the ability to remove this carbon from the atmosphere is becoming much smaller at the point that there is more emission than amount of carbon that is possible to remove.
Well, just so we know where we stand, do current climate models, like those used by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, do they assume forests are a carbon sink or a net carbon source?
It depends on the studies. For example, our studies, for the period of our study that is between the year 2003 and 2014, we actually show that tropical forest has always been a source. Okay, it has never been a sink in this period. In some studies, actually, it has been shown the opposite, that forest before was a significant sink, meaning that it was able to remove more carbon than the carbon that was emitted as a result of deforestation and the degradation. So it depends. It depends which study you are actually consider. And what we like to think is that with this new paper, we provide an independent assessment, a data-driven, measurement-based assessment of what the tropical forests are. Are they a source or are they a sink? And especially because with this study, we are able to report on all different types of disturbances. It's not only emissions from deforestation, but are also emissions from degradation. That is a process that until now has been very difficult to quantify over such a large area.
Now, Alessandro, what techniques did you and your team use to settle this debate?
We use a combination of field data and satellite observation. What we do is that we actually go in the field, we went in the field, and in specific location, we collected measurements in the forest of what the carbon in this forest is. And then we use this information to calibrate the measurements and the signal that we receive from satellites that they provide images of the Earth, in this case, every 2 days. And then when we are able to calibrate those signals with the information on the ground, then through a statistical model, we are able to generate estimate of what the carbon is wherever we have information from the satellite. And so we find that this is a very cost-effective way to do it because satellite observation are able to cover a very, very large area at an extremely low cost. And in this case, actually, the cost was zero because we use data that are free, that are available for free. And that was the goal of our study because we want countries and users and the community to be able to reproduce this data, this exercise, and improve it without having to start with the data acquisition. The data that we use and the software, the code that we use is open source, so it is all free.
How can listeners find out where that is or what it's called?
The satellite data that we use are recorded from the U.S. NASA satellite. It's called MODIS. It has been a very successful program. And if you just Google MODIS, you can go and download the data. The other sensor that we use is a sensor that provides laser measurements of the vegetation. What this sensor provides is information on the vertical structure of the vegetation, so how tall the trees are. And this is it's called the ISAT glass, was a sensor designed to measure the thickness in ice. But the information that collects actually, if properly processed, can be useful for vegetation studies too. And so those data are all free. But of course, part of the hard work in our case was to process this information, because if you just take the information as it is, you will not be able to repeat exactly what we did. So there is a series of processing that needs to be done to the data. If you are interested in the result, you can find the results at www.thecarbonsource.org. It's a website where we post all the data, and you can go there and download the data for the tropics.
Great. I love that. Now, according to your new study, Alessandro, how much carbon is being lost every year from tropical forests?
Our study is indicating that the net loss in tropical forest is 425 petagrams of carbon per year. And that is, just to give you an idea, it's pretty much the amount of emission that cars and trucks in the U.S. are responsible for.
That sounds like a lot to me. I wonder, on our current trajectory, do you think the net loss of carbon from the world's tropical rainforests will grow? And if so, do we know what that rate of increase might be?
That's a very interesting question. And what we find is that forest is under a increasing pressure, meaning that deforestation and disturbance are resulting in a higher stress into the system. And so unless there is a big shift, a big change, we probably expect this to continue and to probably increase. So that means that we might have a larger source, meaning that we will have less and less forest. And so less and less forest means less and less ability of this system to remove carbon from the atmosphere. But there are activities and there is interest at the international level to actually try to stop or to slow down this process. And one positive aspect of our study is that, you know, while we show that tropical forests are a source, well, that means also that if we can invert that process and make tropics a sink, that means that we will be able to remove a lot of CO2 from the atmosphere and have a positive impact on the climate. And right now, that is, I would say, the only technology that is ready, safe, and available for such a large scale. So, you know, yes, right now forests are a source, but hey, let's try to invert that, make forests a sink. And to do that, we need to stop the deforestation, go back and restore forest and landscape that have been degraded. And yes, the old saying, let's just plant trees where we can and let them grow. Because as they grow, they remove carbon from the atmosphere and they will store it in the forest.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking about alarming new science about our tropical forests emitting more carbon to the atmosphere. Our guest from the Woods Hole Research Center is scientist Dr. Alessandro Baccini. Can we assume that global warming itself may further damage the forests, thus creating a positive feedback loop?
That is a concern that we have, and some of our data are actually showing that, yes, there is a negative feedback. And what that negative feedback is, for example, we see in some regions in Brazil is that a series of droughts that happen every 2 or 3 years in the past 12 years are resulting in an increase in mortality within the forest. So there are some species that are not able to react to the lack of rain, and so some of the trees then will start to die. As that happens, also the condition for fires improve, meaning that there is more fuel wood in the forest, there is less humidity, so the condition for fires are much better. So we see also an increase in the frequency of fires. And as the frequency of fires increase, there is, you know, more loss in forests, more loss in biomass, and so the emissions to the atmosphere are increasing.
And beyond the Amazon, which we may have heard about, what other threatened tropical forests did your satellite study find?
Well, the study really focused on the Amazon, on the above-ground woody vegetation. And so the main threats are, yes, some are anthropogenic, so logging and selective logging. But we also find biomass loss due to natural drivers, such as I mentioned, fires or droughts or insects that are also some of the threats. We are now trying to expand the study outside of the tropics to see what the process and what the carbon balance is for the regions outside of the tropics.
Alessandro, what research would you like to take on next?
I would like to try if we can improve the information that we can derive from satellite. And what that means is that we would like to work with satellites that provide more spatial details. The resolution of our data right now is at 500 meters, meaning that we can provide an estimate for an area on the ground of 500 meters by 500 meters, and that sometimes could be a little bit coarse. What we would like to do is to improve it to 30 meters by 30 meters. There is a sensor that is called Landsat, and that will provide this type of analysis. It's just that the amount of computation is a big challenge, but that is something that we would like to do next.
The title of the paper we've been talking about is Tropical Forests Are a Net Carbon Source Based on Above-Ground Measurements of Gain and Loss, as published September 28, 2017. From the Woods Hole Research Center, our guest is the lead author, Dr. Alessandro Baccini. You can find links to follow up on this discussion in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Alessandro, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Resilience is a key word for a spectrum of people, starting with collapsnicks all the way to big city mayors and regional planners. But what is it? Has anybody thought this through? Enter the Community Resilience Reader from the Post Carbon Institute. It's billed as essential resources for an era of upheaval. We certainly have the upheaval. I've reached the book's editor and co-author, Daniel Lurch. Daniel was featured on Radio EcoShock in 2009 from a conference called Gaining Ground, Resilient Cities. He's been on this beat ever since. From Guadalajara, Mexico, Daniel Lurch, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you for having me, Alex. It's good to be here.
Let's start with a no-nonsense scholar from British Columbia, Dr. William Reese. Bill contributes a chapter that asks what we all wonder, does human nature drive us toward collapse? Daniel, talk to us about our apparent inability to steer away from that cliff.
Oh, boy. Well, I guess with any issue in this book, there's going to be hours worth of conversation to unpack it. And you managed to select the one chapter that's probably the most complex, Bill Reese's chapter. So, and for folks who don't recognize his name, Bill Reese is the co-originator of the ecological footprint concept. Everyone's probably heard of the ecological footprint at this point. Bill Reese put that together back in the 90s with his a graduate student, his Matthias Walkernagel. Bill is a fellow of Post Carbon. He contributed a great chapter on our previous reader in 2010, the Post Carbon Reader. That chapter was about resilience, but also kind of touched on these same issues about just the human nature. What is it about human nature that kind of makes us, as he puts it, an unsustainable species, more or less? And what Bill's talking about with that notion of unsustainability of human nature is, you know, and again, it's not necessarily, it's not a value judgment. It's not saying that humans are bad or evil. He's simply looking at the biology, the evolutionary biology of us as a species, and noting that there are things in us and the way that our brains work, the way that we've evolved, that are, in the context of modern industrial society, kind of maladaptive. They just don't work very well. It worked great for getting us out of the savanna and for making us a very successful species that could, you know, end up spreading across the world. But now, as we're reaching 7.5 billion people, some of those things that led our species to success are starting to foul the nest, if you want to put it that way. So some of the things that he talks about, for example, he describes in the beginning of this chapter, the roots of our crises, does human nature drive us to collapse? He starts by describing Homo sapiens as what's called a patch disturbance species, and there's other animals that are like this, and that's basically an animal that will disturb a central area, kind of its camp, if you will, but will also disturb a much larger area as it goes out and forages and gets the resources that it needs. I'm not a biologist, so I can't think of an example in the animal kingdom of that, but you know, you can probably imagine that large warm-blooded animals tend to do that. So you think about that as that works now with humanity and human society. We've gone from occupying, you know, say that small patch around a cave, you know, however many hundreds of thousands of years ago, and foraging into the woods, hunting game, picking, collecting edible plants and whatnot, causing some small-scale disturbance, but, you know, not a whole lot. But now with 7.5 billion people, we're obviously disturbing the entire globe because of just, you know, simply, because this is simply the way that human nature works. We go out, we get resources, and we tend to take a lot. We leave a very big footprint. That's one example of what Bill is talking about. He also gets into things like just how our neurology works. And we have, you know, if you think about the way that we evolve in small groups, where, for example, perhaps the individual early human who was very aggressive, who only thought for himself, who was, you know, perhaps selfish in some ways, that one was going to probably be the most successful because he would have gotten the most resources and he would have successfully mated. Bill makes an interesting observation that, you know, those sorts of behaviors are adaptive at an individual level, but are maladaptive at a collective level. If you have the same sorts of behaviors, but you're talking about a larger society, it obviously doesn't work very well to have an entire society full of aggressive, selfish thinking people. So those are the kinds of things that Bill talks about in this chapter, and we included it in the book because we felt it was important to recognize that when we're talking about sustainability, when we're talking about resilience, it's not enough just to look at laws and policies and the purchasing decisions that we make as humans. We really need to think about why do we do the things that we do, whether as individuals or as families or as communities. So this chapter essentially on neuroscience and biology was really essential to us to include in this book.
It's hard to give specific step-by-step plans when the menu of possible threats is so great. I mean, we've got everything from, well, nuclear weapons, we hope not, but we do have climate change and natural disasters, if there are any natural disasters these days. Daniel Lurch, how can we develop a toolbox for such a big range of possible disruptions?
Yeah, another big question. I mean, that's kind of how it is when we talk about resilience. Let me back up there a little bit and see if I can approach this in a way that's gonna be useful. Part of why we talk about resilience in this book, and why we talk about resilience in Post-Carbon Institute as a concept, is this idea that we face so many crises, we face so many challenges as a society, as individuals, that it simply doesn't work anymore to think of them in the way that we've thought about sustainability issues, say, over the last 30 years, where we say, we imagine the ideal outcome that we want to achieve, and then we kind of backcast and figure out, okay, what do we need to do to get to that outcome? So, for example, say we decide, well, we want to run everything off of wind and solar power. Okay, well, let's go backwards and see what are the things that we need to change in order to do that. We need to get electric cars, we need to change the power plants, that sort of thing. That's a perfectly valid way of approaching an issue, but obviously it's also very compartmentalized. It's very linear. And reality, any reality in this world, obviously is complex. And when we get to sustainability crises, they're particularly complex. One of the reasons why we tend to use the word complex as opposed to complicated, for example, is that a complex problem has emergent properties, things that pop up that are really unpredictable. It has influences from outside the system. It has processes within inside the system. If you're looking at a complex set of problems or any sort of complex system, you can't just, again, aim for a particular outcome and try to figure out the right recipe or the right menu to get there. It just doesn't work that way. one of the sets of authors in our book, Brian Walker and David Salt, they essentially wrote the book on resilience science, that is, for lay people. And one of the examples that they give in describing this idea of complexity is that something that's complicated is, just think of like a Swiss watch. There's a lot going on in there. There are a lot of moving parts. But you can essentially take it apart, look at it, figure out how it works, put it back together again, and it'll work the way that it did before. Complexity is very different. Complexity, like I said, is there's aspects, there are emergent properties, and an emergent property is essentially something that kind of happens or kind of is created or arises when other things are coming together, and it's not necessarily predictable. So to get back to this idea, why do we talk about resilience instead of sustainability? And why do we not necessarily go for the typical sustainability toolkit, as you mentioned, is that resilience science is focused on understanding the processes of how systems work. Another author and a scientist who I respect very much, Charles Redman at Arizona State University, he wrote a very influential article a couple of years ago describing this connection and the relationship between sustainability and resilience. And he's the one that kind of pointed out very clearly that sustainability as a practice tends to prioritize outcomes. Again, like let's get to 50% renewable energy or let's all drive Priuses or something. Whereas resilience science prioritizes process. Resilience science gets us thinking about, okay, why does this system work the way that it does? What are the characteristics of this system that lead to certain responses? Again, and value neutral, it doesn't matter if it's, you know, if it's good or bad, that assessment comes later, but just trying to understand what's happening and why so that we can then knowingly and in an informed manner make some decisions about how to change that system. So when it comes to the toolbox then, you know, the tools that we need for doing resilience work, for trying to build the resilience of the systems that we care about, they're essentially systems thinking tools. They're tools that help us think about, well, if this one portion of this system, and again, when I say system, it could be anything. It could be an ecosystem. It could be an urban community. It could be something as small as, you know, a garden. It could be something as large as a subway system or a regional economy or whatever. Systems thinking helps us look at these things, and it gives us mental tools for understanding, okay, well, when this happens and this next thing happens, it has this response. But these other sets of things happen, and there's a different response. So we start using terms like, okay, well, there's a feedback loop happening over here. There's a stock over here and a flow over here. I mean, we don't have time to get into a crash course in systems thinking, but those are the kinds of tools that we need to start using. You know, they're mental tools. Obviously, we also need to have, I guess, what you could call manual skills or more practical skills as well, because once we start thinking about, you know, what's happening and say, in my community, why does my community work the way that it does, and I want to change it. Well, if I want to change it, then maybe I need some skills like group facilitation, you know, public speaking, group organizing, or getting out there and you know, learning how to do repairs and you know, gardening and whatever else, and all the different grassroots kinds of activist things that have been happening in American communities for the last 30 years or so. So I guess that's kind of the long answer to your question. What toolkit do we need? I would say it's both the practical toolkit, but especially the mental toolkit, the toolkit of systems thinking.
I totally agree, but I do disagree, and this is just a minor point, with one definition of resilience given by the co-authors Brian Walker and David Salt. They write, quote, "Put simply, resilience is the ability to cope with shocks and keep functioning in much the same way as before." But of course, I think we definitely should not aim to keep functioning as before. I mean, we don't want to keep rebuilding roads and going on with business as usual, because that's killing the planet. Maybe we don't need to bounce back. Maybe we need to bounce forward or bounce very differently. Is that a concept covered by resilience?
Oh, absolutely. And that particular definition from Brian Walker and David Salt, that is their put simply definition. I mean, in that chapter, and in their other writings, they describe, I think, very clearly and very eloquently how, again, resilience science is, at its most basic, you can use it to try to get your system to respond to disruption and to go back to the way it was working. But also part of resilience thinking is understanding, you know, as I said, why do things work the way they do? How can we change that? And we can use that information then to change things for the better if we want to. For example, there's a concept in resilience science called transformability. And that has to do with when a system experiences a large disruption, if it's kind of the classic example is a forest experiencing wildfire. If the forest has sufficient resilience, it'll experience that wildfire and, you know, some trees will get burned and underbrush will get burned, but it'll essentially bounce back and become and be the same kind of system it was before. If, you know, climate had been changing and it hasn't been getting enough water and it's especially dry, then the disturbance could be so great that it actually transforms into something different. Maybe it doesn't come back as a Maple Beach ecosystem. Maybe it comes back as a grassland. Or you can think about this as, in terms of a human system. You know, if there's maybe, you know, a tornado, kind of another classic example, a tornado rips through town. Well, if it's not too destructive and if there's sufficient resilience, you know, the town kind of comes back and people keep going the way that they had been. But if it's especially destructive or if there's low resilience, then maybe the town never recovers and it becomes a different kind of town. Transformability, then, is this idea that, well, we can kind of plant different kinds of seeds for when, and again, metaphorical seeds, if you want to think of it that way, for when a disturbance does happen, that new things can be ready to take their place and the system itself can transform overall. It's all described in the book.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. My guest is Daniel Lurch from the Post-Carbon Institute. He's the editor of the Community Resilience Reader, and that's what we're talking about. You know, you brought out the very important fact that we have to take into account our mental state and abilities when we're looking at these things. And there's a new book out saying Donald Trump is mentally ill, but I think our whole society is mentally ill. We burn fossil fuels. We do all these things that wipe out species and wreck the planet. How can we build resilience within what we could call a massive social illness?
Boy, you've got big questions.
I do.
Well, that's why you're a successful radio host. No, but these are excellent questions. And that is a tough one. How do we build resilience within as a society? You know, I think the first thing that comes to mind for that is actually education. And we happen to have a chapter on education in the Community Resilience Reader, partly for that very reason, that to get back to mental models, as you mentioned, if we're not understanding our own behavior as a society and our own behavior as individuals, we don't understand why we are creating the kind of destruction that we create, why we are extracting the kind of non-renewable resources that we're extracting and getting ourselves dependent on this thing. If we don't understand the why behind that, then we're never going to be able to get beyond it. And a lot of that does come down to education. And so I'm in my 40s. When I went through the public school system, I never learned anything about, you know, why. I mean, I learned, okay, we use gasoline and coal for these things, but I never learned why. You never learn, you know, someone made a decision at some point, or rather these things were discovered, and we just kind of proceeded to use them without thinking about the future very much. And one example of something that would be very useful for students of any age, but I think particularly in teenagers and college, is to understand, well, what are the things that were not questioned when we were making these early decisions about how to run modern industrial society? You know, why did we go for centuries burning wood and then burning coal? And God, Lord, wood. I mean, we created so much destruction just burning wood. Entire forests around the world leveled. How is it that very few people ever thought about, you know, whether that's sustainable or not, and what's the history behind how that thinking started to change? And just a couple of weeks ago, actually, I finished a very interesting biography on the Prussian, I don't want to call him a geographer because he was really a Renaissance man, but the Prussian scientist Alexander von Humboldt. It's called The Mention of Nature. And Humboldt was one of those early, I would say even original thinker back in the late 1700s, early 1800s. He was trying to understand how does nature all fit together? How do the microscopic and the macroscopic pieces all relate? You know, people, we essentially really didn't think about that sort of thing before. The biography talks about how he traveled through South America and he kind of witnessed how people, the European colonists, grazing their animals on these what used to be virgin lands in what is now Venezuela had caused incredible environmental destruction and simply weren't thinking about it. It was just, you know, that's just the way it is. It's just how nature works. It's kind of crazy to me that in the 21st century, we have a lot of people around the world who also really do not think about that, or that it's, maybe they have a vague sense that, yeah, if I drive a car, if I burn this piece of wood, it's going to have some effect, but I don't really understand how or the significance. So there's basic scientific literacy that needs to happen for that. To me, the connection to resilience there is that resilience helps us understand that a system, any system, as I mentioned before, can be resilient and can persist for a long period of time. But resilient science tells us that there comes a certain point where maybe the resilience is challenged, is pushed so far that we hit a tipping point, and then everything starts to change. And that tipping point itself is often unpredictable. Like probably everyone listening to this show understands that, say, take climate change. We all kind of understand that we might hit a tipping point with atmospheric carbon concentrations beyond which we start getting runaway climate change. Things like that, again, in that mental toolkit, in that societal toolkit, I think are really important. If everyone understood these things, or at least understood more how the world worked, how these systems work, I think we might have certainly different cultural and hopefully different political outcomes as well.
Well, we are starting to run out of time, but I wanted to ask you, are there case studies showing that community resilience works?
There are case studies at the rural level, and that's essentially where resilience science came from. And when I say the rural level, I'm talking about, you know, imagine a farming community that's dependent upon, you know, a certain area of farmland and the watershed surrounding it. Or, say, a fishing community that's dependent upon the fishery out in the ocean. They're dependent on that for their livelihood. So I think it was about 30 or maybe even 40 years ago, ecologists started to study these communities. And I call them rural, but maybe they're better thought of it as natural resource-dependent communities. I mean, we're all dependent on natural resources, of course, but you know, there's rural communities often depend on one particular resource for their livelihood. So these scientists were trying to understand, you know, how do the decisions, how does this, the system of humans on one side and the system of the ecology on the other side, how do those two interact? How do they actually function as a joint system, or what they call a social-ecological system? So the models exist in the rural area. They don't quite exist yet in the urban area. And that's partly why we did this book, because we really wanted to promote this idea that we can take what has been learned in these rural communities and in the science overall and start to apply it to urban settings. Urban settings are much, much more complex. You've got many, many more people. You've got many different layers of modern industrial society, the economy and industry, of culture, especially in multicultural communities. There's a ton more going on, and the work on that has really just started, I'd say, in the last 5 to 10 years. But certainly the indications, I think, are that there's a lot to learn from resilient science, and there's a lot that's applicable even to modern industrial society.
Well, listeners, we don't need the nightly news to know some tough punches are coming, and we do need to be able to bounce back somehow. Island Press has just published the Community Resilience Reader, Essential Resources for an Era of Upheaval. You can search for that title or find a link to the book webpage in my show blog at ecoshock.org. And of course, you should explore postcarbon.org. Our guest has been the editor of the new Resilience Reader, Daniel Lurch. Thank you so much, Daniel.
Thank you, Alex. It was a pleasure to be here again.
We're out of time. Please join me again next week for more Radio EcoShock.